The Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation for the Senate and House. And right now I am the Senate, and we'll give it to the House, who has decided to have better representation.
I am going to call the House Transportation Committee to order. And welcome, everybody, and thank you for showing off the Senate today.
You only need me. That's all.
And I think our audience probably is very familiar with most of us here, with the exception of our one newcomer. So I'm going to go ahead and let Representative introduce herself.
Okay, thank you. I'm Representative Margaret Doherty. I represent House District 35, which is Larry Galizio's old district, Tigard, King City, Metzger, a little bit of Portland, a little bit of Beaverton. I've been involved and around for a while. I was a teacher for 10 years and worked for the Oregon Education Association for 22, and when I retired, I began a floral business, and been doing that for the past 3-4 years. And I'm very, very glad to be here. It's a very exciting new part of my life. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
What's your take on the Columbia River crossing?
Don't answer that.
I represent Washington County, and we don't care. No. Washington County is we're far from the Columbia.
Thank you, and yeah, welcome to the committee. We are going to miss Representative Bailey, but you are a great addition.
Thank you very much.
So, and with that, we have some committee rules to adopt. Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The committee rules should be for the House members right underneath your agenda, comprising the two comprise your packet for today. They are the boilerplate rules that were provided by the Chief Clerk of the House. They're the standard rules that all the committees will be operating for under the interim.
Need a motion, Madam Chair. I move we adopt the rules.
Representative Schaffler has moved that we adopt the rules. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. And with that, I would pass it over to the Senate to adopt their rules, but yeah.
We have no rules.
Yes. the next thing that was on the agenda is the review of the committee work plan. So, Patrick, we don't have it in front of us, so what are we doing with that?
Madam Chair, we do have copies of the work plan, I believe, that we can distribute if it's the Chair's desire to do so, and then we can...
It might be helpful for people to get a copy of that. That way, if they're seeing something that should be on there or shouldn't be on there, they can then let me know. And with that, we'll go ahead and get those distributed today during the meeting. And I think that's all of the organizational business that we have, and we will go ahead and move on to the informational hearing, which is an update on transportation projects funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And thank everybody for coming and being willing to talk to us about your successes, and hopefully not too many frustrations. So. With that, I'm going to ask Matt Garrett to come up.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Matthew Garrett. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm here to provide you with a status report of how we're doing with the ARRA funds, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Federal stimulus dollars specific to transportation. Now, you recall that the bill was signed into law back in February of 2009. And if you think back, there was some conversation as the new administration came on board that it would literally be on President Obama's desk the very first day he assumed. That was pushed back a little. That prompted us to engage this conversation back in the December-January timeframe, thinking that indeed, with the new administration, we were going to hit the ground running. So we had a little time to work this. The bottom line, just to give you the context of this, it provided the state of Oregon $334 million in funds to be administered by the Oregon Department of Transportation. That breaks down into the following categories. Roughly $234 million allocated to ODOT. It comes two separate pots, one surface transportation dollars, about $224 million, and then $10 million allocated on top of that for transportation enhancements. So roughly $234 million. There was an allocation of about $100 million that was sub-allocated to the cities, the counties, and the metropolitan planning organizations. In addition to that flow of money, Oregon received about $75.9 million in federal transit formula dollars. This broke itself out into urban transit. Those are the big transit districts, the TriMets, the Lanes, the Salems. Money flowing at about $61 million to those works. And then to the smaller rural and small transportation districts throughout the state, about $14.6 million. So overall, a significant flow of money coming into the state of Oregon. Now, with this money came conditions or caveats, strings, some people refer to it. Stringent timelines. Again, they wanted to move this money very quickly. Clothed in the jobs creation, jobs sustaining, jobs saving garment. They wanted to move very quickly. That said, it required the monies going to the various states to allocate, to obligate 50% of their money within 120 days. So they want us to run very quickly. The remaining dollars coming to the state, and then the monies flowing to local governments, we had a full year to engage and obligate those dollars, which puts us at about a March 1st, 2010 time frame to obligate all this investment. There was priority directed toward economically distressed areas. We must, with these dollars, continue to meet the federal aid requirements. So the disciplines imposed from FHWA and the federal government in terms of procurement protocols, design standards, right-of-way acquisition disciplines, as well as environmental compliance, those were not removed. What they also suggested that these stimulus dollars could not supplant monies that had been identified to fund projects. So you could not replace these monies. These had to be new projects that there was not money available for. What they did waive was any match requirement. So literally 100% money came to these types of projects. It certainly was helpful. So again, going back to the end of 2008, moving into January of 2009, ODOT developed a project list of roughly 46 projects across the state. These were projects that had been reviewed and engaged in by our area commissions on transportation, or information coming from our various management systems, the pavement, the bridge management systems that identify some of the deficits within our system. We looked for projects that had characteristics of project readiness, hit the ground running very quickly. We looked for projects that had minimum or no design work needed, minimum or no right-of-way that needed to be acquired, minimum or no environmental work. We wanted a clean project so we could hit the ground running and put the boots on the ground this summer construction season. ODOT submitted this list of 46 for comment. We came back in February where the commission received comment from folks and eventually approved 41 projects totaling $132.6 million. Covering the obligation we had to meet the 120-day project obligation requirements. So we got that out of the way. We weren't going to trip not getting the 50% amount out and the time frames identified in the bill. Running very fast. Come early March, we came back and the OTC starts to engage in a process for the remaining $100 million now. And what they decided to do that was allocated to the state, ODOT, and we certainly had a menu of projects that we could have funded specifically, but the OTC, they stepped back, they listened to folks and said, listen, the need is across all the system, across all modes. And again, one of the things that I failed to mention was the flexibility that came with this federal dollar. The surface transportation funds are the most flexible of all federal dollars that flow to the various states. So the OTC say, open this up for all folks. Come forth and submit projects to compete for this $101 million. I will tell you that was well received. Folks did come to the table. There were 330 applications received by 170 jurisdictions, totaling more than $500 million to compete for this $101 million we had to allocate. 80 representatives from 80 jurisdictions testified before a special meeting that my commission had, articulating the needs, the wants, and the merits of these various projects. Excuse me, after taking this information in, the commission directed ODOT to come up with a recommendation, and they charged us with using a host of criteria. Again, leading the way was project readiness, jobs this summer construction season. They also wanted to look for leverage opportunities. How can we build and complement investments going on? They wanted to make sure the investment benefited the statewide transportation system. They wanted projects that had short and long-term economic benefits for the state of Oregon. They wanted to facilitate modal choice. They wanted geographical balance, and they wanted to make sure we were focusing on that commitment of investment in economically distressed areas. And I will tell you that when we step back and look at the flow of investment, 70% of the money did indeed flow to those areas that were deemed economically distressed. So we ran fast with that criteria, ginned up a recommendation. We came back to the commission on March 18th, where the OTC approved 59 projects for $101 million. Again, state projects, local government projects, projects that cross all modes of transportation. So we had our universe. We thought that would indeed expend the whole of the money coming to us. But what we started to realize over the months of April, May, and June, that the project costs were coming in lower than we expected. We were receiving very favorable bids. In addition to that, there were a couple local projects that were canceled. So we started to accrue a balance of roughly $43 million, $42.8 million to be specific. In July, the commission came back and directed the balance of funds to the following investments. They identified eight projects, we had identified eight projects, that actually had come in over the bid price. They wanted to make sure those projects that did have merit were fully funded. So they said direct some of these savings to eight projects totaling about $1.3 million. They also said existing projects on the ground right now, if you can change and extend the scope of the work through a contract change order, let us do that seamless act. We identified 14 projects where we could extend the work and keep people moving to the tune of about $4.6 million. Opportunities in terms of renewable energy, resource efforts, and our investment in the solar highway program. To complement a $1.7 million investment made by the Department of Energy with some of their stimulus dollars, the Commission put on the table $2 million to continue to move forth with an opportunity we see in West Lynn. And then finally, the significant conversation about an exposure we have with regard to rail. The Commission, after long and hard conversations about the vulnerability of rail service, and recall that we leased the trains from the state of Washington, and they will call those trains back home sometime in 2010. The issue is, while we had early conversations, the early part of the Vision Committee discussion, leading into the Jobs and Transportation Act, House Bill 2001, we lost the monies directed to the train. That's fine. Just took a funding stream off the table. So the Commission continued to look at opportunities in terms of funding. Looked at the additional federal dollars available to them, but the timing was such that when a decision was made, it would be too late, we would have lost the trains. And also with any federal request, it's always a crapshoot that you'll get what you ask for if you get anything. And then finally, they looked at Connect Oregon, to be very honest with you. Again, a very disciplined and successful process to engage project selection. This would have been somewhat of a deviation if we would have taken $35 million off the $45 million which will be available for discretionary investment. So with all that said, saying let us not blemish successful opportunities, let us not ignore the bird in the hand opportunity we have with this $35 million. Again, intense discussion, not unanimous, but they made the decision to flex, use this money in that multimodal manner, and send $35 million to purchase train equipment. So to date, that gives you where we stand as we led up to the decisions identifying the projects, as we dealt with some savings that were accrued because of, favorable bid prices and projects falling by the wayside. I can report to you that right now, to date, 80% of the funds available to the state that came to ODOT have been obligated. The remainder of that fund are the projects that we've just kicked in, mostly the largest amount being the trains that we haven't obligated. And I will tell you, we are in negotiations with the state of Wisconsin, who is looking as well to purchase a train set. And we're, again, the legal folks are trying to sync up the request for a proposal. We think we'll get a better bang for the buck if we partner with the state of Wisconsin. And it is my understanding Amtrak may be asking some questions of partnering in that as well. So we think there may be an opportunity to save on that effort if we can get those partnerships moving forward. So that's the snapshot specific to the monies that were allocated specifically to the Department of Transportation. Now, I know my city and county partners will be up here to share their thoughts on this, but what I thought I'd do now is quickly fly over the local government program, because we are responsible for that, and also tell you of the other opportunities that have presented themselves with regard to federal stimulus, and give you a quick snapshot of what has come in certain areas and what is to be engaged. So I'll move quickly, knowing my local government partners will certainly tell their story much better than I can. Again, following the rules of the game associated with the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, states were required to send that 30%, that $100 million of through the Surface Transportation Program Formula discipline. So right off the top, the way this works, right off the top, roughly $50 million goes to the big MPOs, those MPOs with populations of over 200,000. So you have the Metro folks up in the Portland area, you have Salem-Keizer, and then you have Eugene-Springfield folks. Those monies were allocated to those large MPOs, and then within those MPOs, the projects were selected and they were submitted and selected by the jurisdictions contained within that boundary. So that's the way we took care of the big urban-type areas. We have a working agreement with our cities and counties of how, and our federal partners, of how the STP monies flow. Monies that flow to the cities with populations of over 5,000, but not within that MPO boundary. So we allocate monies based on populations to those folks. We also look at the counties and those smaller MPOs, those areas of Corvallis, Rogue Valley, and out in Bend, and we send money out to them based on populations. The bottom line, roughly $44 million went to those local partners for them to adjudicate and make decisions as to where to invest that money. The STP formula doesn't address cities with populations of less than 5,000. It's just not the way the game is played. We didn't think it fair that our brethren across the state and those smaller cities couldn't play in this. So working very closely with the cities and counties, we came up with a $5 million set aside so those smaller cities could compete for this money. And again, a lot of the appetite that we saw expressed at that big public meeting the commission had, where we had all the jurisdictions come in, a lot of the mayors of small cities, be it Depot Bay Pendleton, it's a bigger city, but again, you're getting a flavor of who came. That's where those folks came and articulated the need and the merits of their projects. So $5 million set aside. That wrapped up, for all intents and purposes, the flow of the $100 million. And I think you have identified in the second attachment a list of the 52 local government projects that they funded with that money. Now, to date, our records show that 47% of the ERA funds flowing to local governments have been obligated. Numbers not quite as high as we'd want it to be, but we're working very closely with those folks to make sure they understand the gravity, they understand the timelines, and the last thing the state of Oregon wants to do is send any money back to the federal government. So we have some disciplines in terms of calendars as to when you need to package up all your project specifications and estimates to make sure that we can obligate this money by that March 1st, 2010 timeframe. We've also worked very hard to streamline some opportunities for local government. Again, it's not lost on us that some of our smaller communities don't have the capacity to deal with this federal money. It comes with strings, as I said. Those conditions were laid on and they were not taken up. So what we tried to do, at least on the environmental side, was to secure a single document that took care of all the issues rather than going through the litany of paperwork. And working with FHWA, the cities and the counties, we did indeed secure that single environmental document for the local projects. That was a significant step forward to move things in a much faster pace. We also made available fund exchange, the fund exchange program we have, where we literally trade out state money for federal dollars. Again, removing the strings. Our local jurisdictions are much more comfortable working with the disciplines that the state applies rather than having the federal disciplines. They just don't experience that often. So the fund exchange was a financial tool that we put on the table, and I think especially the smaller jurisdictions found it extremely helpful. I turn your attention to attachment 3. That's when we start to speak about the public transit projects. I mentioned the $75.9 million of federal transit funds that were allocated to the state. Again, $61 million going to TriMet, Salem Transit, and Lane Transit District. Those folks dealt with that. They actually dealt directly with the Federal Transit Administration. So that was, you know, that was an effort that they engaged. The small and rural transit districts flowed through my transit portfolio. We had $14.6 million available. We ran through our various processes, identified 34 projects that we made investments, mostly in capital construction. We're talking about buses and facilities, but we moved that forward. And again, those type projects are identified in the attachment 3 you have. There are additional discretionary opportunities that, again, we are trying to position the state of Oregon to secure as much money as we can to bring back home to the state. Transit expansion, the new starts. Here's where Lane Transit and TriMet secured some investments. TriMet receiving a little over $32 million for the continued work there on the expansion of MAX on 205 into the Portland Mall area, and Lane Transit almost $3 million for purchases of the MX buses, the bus rapid transit that they have down in that area. Several types of discretionary grants, TIGR grants. First to come out, about $100 million. TIGR stands for Transit Investment for Greenhouse Gas and Energy Reduction. Again, Lane Transit and TriMet secured some monies with regard to cooling mechanisms and other energy type engine transitions from diesel to hybrid type investments. We submitted about 18 projects in total. Those two good folks secured some funds. Marion County, for the Buena Vista Ferry, received $3.2 million under the category of ferry boats and facilities. So kudos to them for securing that money. TIGR grants now, different from TIGR, TIGR grants, $1.5 billion of discretionary money made available. TIGR stands for Transit Investments Generating Economic Recovery. Again, flexible dollars, multimodal in its approach, looking for projects that promote economic competition, livability. How do you enhance livability with these investments? How do you secure safety? How do we make the system more safe? And then how do you make sure you're making investments that overall help put the system in a state of good repair? We have submitted 21 projects, both the state and local governments. We bundled things off. We shipped it back to D.C. We tried to match up as best we could the projects with the criteria that had been identified, and we expect awards coming for the TIGR grant sometime in 2010. High-speed rail, $8 billion identified to improve inner-city passenger rail traffic. And the Federal Rail Administration oversees this activity, and they are focused on the 10 federally designated high-speed rail corridors. In August, we submitted an initial application of about $113 million to upgrade the performance of our Northwest high-speed rail corridor. It's another opportunity in October to refine an application for some investments as well, and we're working very closely with the state of Washington to make sure that we are positioning the Northwest to secure as much high-speed rail discretionary money as possible. I will also tell you, going back to the $35 million that the commission directed to train sets or train equipment, The argument goes that if we make an investment here, we show a level of effort. We think we have positioned these requests in better stead. So we're trying to leverage statewide investment with hopefully federal investment. So again, another factor in as to why they directed money to the trains. So Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, to summarize what we have seen, when you look at all aspects of stimulus dollars flowing in to the state of Oregon specific to transportation, we have been provided more than $460 million to preserve and improve the transportation system in the state of Oregon. It certainly has been an economic jolt. That certainly was an underpinning of the federal stimulus dollars. There is no question that it has saved jobs in the state of Oregon. One of the most fulfilling things I have had over the last summer is to go around and look at these jobs and talk with the contractors, talk with the laborers, and hearing the stories of how they have been brought back from being laid off. Hearing the contractors say, I've been able to invest in my organization now because I've secured this money. It fulfilled that purpose. There is no question about it. And then finally, I think it's brought benefit to the transportation system as a whole across all modes. So with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I'll stand down and receive any questions you may have.
Thank you. Committee, any questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that presentation, Director Garrett. I think you've rightly emphasized the import of retaining and creating jobs. Do you have an early estimate yet on the number of jobs that were retained or created during the summer months?
We have used a methodology that actually dates back to the OT investments, where for every $1 million of investment, what we are saying now, it creates 14 family wage jobs. And we have validated that. Now, not even going back to the OT investments, but if we look at the Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project, we actually have done the work and we've come out very close. So we have, I think, validated that methodology. And when you do the math, with all the gives and the takes, roughly 5,000, we anticipate roughly 5,000 jobs.
Yes. Another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the speed of distribution of either the state or local dollars, are there any state-imposed barriers, things that we should consider for the February session?
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't think so. I mean, that was one of the things we tried to get out in front of, remove all the barriers. And I will tell you, we have had a very, very strong partner with our federal highway administrator, Mr. Disler, is here. We worked very hard not to allow process to get in the way of delivering projects. And I think the same applies for the cities and counties. What we tried to do is, again, we will not embarrass the state of Oregon. We will deliver on these investments. And if we do that, we just might receive money from other states that can't cross the finish line.
One last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. About the Tiger Grants, not the Tiger Grants, but
yeah.
The Tiger Grants.
Yeah.
Were those projects that you selected coordinated at all with the Oregon Business Development Department in terms of selecting projects that are in line with our statewide economic development strategy?
We actually started having close conversations, because what we wanted to make sure is the policy of the state of Oregon, I apologize, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, what we want to make sure is the policy conversations lead into investment strategies. So as we work through the Jobs and Transportation Act, we wanted to make sure that if we had opportunities, say, out in the Hillsborough area, did we have the infrastructure to help promote that? We are tightening up that relationship. I think it played itself out in this conversation.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And Matt, thank you for all this. This is good. These projects, I paced through them quickly, and they're all broken up in a lot of small increments, and there's some substantial projects. This is just a yes or a no. I imagine, like the $77,000 in Happy Valley, they have an ongoing street maintenance project that just augments, adds to, and helps them. Or was there a specific project that they had to come up with and show you?
They had to show a project. Yes.
All right. Thank you. And then, but that isn't the total project. That's just money that they got to add to probably.
It very well could be.
And then on these protocols, you said procurement protocols. You're required to report to the federal government exactly what you're doing with this money. You don't have the answers if you don't know. But I'd like to know how small increments you have to report. I mean, what dollar amount do you go down to in reporting to the? Are you required to report to the federal government? What incremental dollar amount are you required to report how the money's spent, where it goes? And is that true then for the local governments? If you're using federal money to pass on to local governments, are they as entities required to report that at that same level of specificity? And then when you use state money instead of Fed to get around some of these, to break down barriers, as you put it, is that requirement standard continued through, or is that one of the barriers you break down?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, again, one of the, I guess one of the overlays on this expenditure was transparency and accountability. I think we have the TARP program to thank for that, but it's not a bad thing. But it does, it gets down to a gnat's eye in terms of reporting. So that cuts across all jurisdictions here. And Mr. Disser may be able to articulate this more eloquently than I had. But we are not missing anything. We are showing the trail in the investments as to where this money goes, because that was a theme that was banged home very early from the administration.
One more, please. And okay, what's the dollar? Under 50 cents, $1, $5, and where can I go find that as a taxpayer?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we will get that information, and I'll break it down to exactly what degree do we have to report to. It's going to be a very fine and granular look.
And once again, Madam Chair, please. And if Joe taxpayer or Joanne taxpayer wants to find that, is it easily accessible?
Thinking of websites, certainly, again, something that was promoted because of transparency and accountability. We have websites that speak to each of these issues. Federal government has one, and we have been charged at the state to articulate that and share with the good folks where the money's going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Metzger.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger, my apologies.
Thank you for your report, Mr. Garrett. On the savings that for the ARRA that have materialized, is that window closed, or do we may still have at the end of the day some other dollars that may still be saved from some of these projects, or do we totally know what that bottom line figure is, or is there maybe a little bit more that might still show up?
Mr. Chairman, the window is almost closed. I mean, we anticipate some positive on the remaining projects, some favorable bids. We think that's going to continue. We see that. But I think the decisions, for the most part, we've identified the universe. We're moving on those. We have a few projects that need to be obligated. So there may be some things that are still out there. But the window is very close to being shut.
Okay, and then on the train, you know, we've all, just like we do with these projects, we kind of come up with round numbers, $35 million for a train, but, you know, there's really not based on anything other than, you know, a ballpark figure. And you talked about perhaps partnering with the state of Wisconsin to, again, achieve the goal of getting the replacement train at a most favorable cost. And so there is at least some anticipation that that actually could potentially be less than the $35 million, depending on how successful we are.
I suppose you could say could. Yeah. We're doing our best. We think we're very close to the mark. But again, if other folks play, we would see probably a downward trend in terms of the cost. Okay. That's what we're hoping. Let's put it that way.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Garrett, I've been traveling back and forth for 8 years from Coos Bay to the Valley. And I just want to tell you that the projects that you have on the ground have been the smoothest moving of traffic that I have seen in my time of traveling back and forth. Very short delays, very, very attentive and courteous people working on the road. And I really want you to know that. And I have a lot of history to compare. And it's been the very best this summer that I've seen. As the director of the agency, because you do have so much work on the ground, do you feel the challenge that of being sure that at the end of the day that all of these projects have been done in the way they were supposed to be done, the money spent right? I mean, how do you, it's huge. And I just wonder if you might address that a little
sure.
bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, it's an excellent question, and the investment is significant. I have good business partners. And when I say business partners, I'm talking about the contractors, the laborers who are delivering the project. So the kudos really go to them in terms of the smoothness of the project. I have great folks at the Oregon Department of Transportation, set of eyes that oversee and help direct the delivery of these projects. I have a great partner with the Federal Highway Administration as well, who helps vet these type of things. There are a lot of eyes on these projects to make sure that the dollars are going to where we have said they are going to go, that the projects are being delivered. So when I look at the various partners, we are successful because we have healthy partnerships, whether it's the freight community, the trucking industry, or the contractors. We are all working together to make the investment deliver the dividend. Because the bottom line, there is no question that if we are successful here, I think we have positioned ourselves for greater success.
Okay.
And I'm very happy. I am anxious because there's a lot going on. You have given us an outstanding opportunity to show, just to show how good we are with the House, with House Bill 2001, the Jobs and Transportation Act. But I would be misrepresenting the truth if I didn't say, with all the charge given to us, with the great opportunities for us to engage the transportation industry in delivering that, there's a lot to do, and I'm a little anxious about that. But I know I have good business partners to help me deliver it, and it's being reflected in the delivery of these stimulus dollars.
Thank you. And Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just as a comment, I had to drive clear across the state to get here, Mr. Director, and I actually had to wait quite a while at all those projects. I just want to have the record show that your folks running those signs are extremely pleasant, and I got to talk to two of them. and that was great. I have a question for you, though, that forgive me, but this is a lot of money, $500 million almost invested in our state, but I'm just curious how big the bucket is, because it looks like a lot of money. But in your opinion, two questions. First, is it going to make a noticeable difference in our transportation system, noticeable in the sense of having more income generated as a result of being able to get places faster? And secondly, had you had more time to figure out where to spend the money, could you have done a better job?
First question, Madam Chair, Representative Benz, it's a good question. But I think we have shared with you the enormous appetite, the enormous need in transportation infrastructure. $500 million is a lot of money. But I think for a specific conversation for House Bill 2001, we brought forth a $10 billion list that was very specific to the type of projects. So the appetite's enormous. Now, I will say with this investment, we have created a healthier transportation infrastructure, which I think equates to a healthier state economy. I've shared with you my thoughts about the contractors, the trades folks that I've talked to. We've made a difference. Those are the things that resonate with me. So yes, I think the money is producing the dividends, but the appetite's enormous. Now, I always reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. And if you give me a little time, if I'm doing my homework, maybe we could have come up with a different mix. But I'll tell you, the universe of need is massive. And the projects that we chose were good projects.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Phil Ditzler, the Oregon Division Administrator for the Federal Highway Administration, is welcome. We appreciate your being here.
My pleasure. Madam Chair, Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, representatives, very much on behalf of the Federal Highway Administration, appreciate this opportunity just to share a few words with regard to how the Recovery Act is being delivered here in Oregon. So I'll just run through those. You know, the federal government has asked a great deal from the state of Oregon and from the Oregon Department of Transportation. The $334 million, that's with regard to the highway program, that's a huge number. That is very much essentially doubling the federal aid program into Oregon in the calendar year. And it's moving that money directly into construction. Typically, the federal aid program in Oregon is roughly $400 million. That goes into many places. You know, it does go into construction, but it's diluted a bit. The Recovery Act is going all into construction, so it's a big lift. You know, and asking that lift of the state of Oregon, we've also asked some very tough deadlines. We've asked for a 120-day, 50% delivery by the state, all of the money to be obligated within 1 year. We've asked the state to consider the economically distressed areas and to consider that when projects are selected. We've had certification requirements. We've had reporting requirements. We've asked that it be done by the book, and that is just as Director Garrett indicated. You know, that is the contracting requirements. That's the civil rights requirements. That's the environmental requirements. There's a whole host of laws that are in place when these federal funds are spent that need to be complied with. And from the beginning, the federal government, it was written that it would be done by the book. And so that again is asking a lot to compress the development time and get these projects out to construction. But ODOT did begin planning very early. You know, it was December of last year that they started pulling lists together and very much positioning the state to have an internal dialogue on a list of projects, something tangible. And it very much put the state way ahead of the curve when the bill was finally signed and money came to the state. So the work that was done within the director's office and in the state of Oregon to have that discussion, get those projects selected and moving forward, that was tremendous. 2 points that really stand out to me when I look across all the states and to see how it's been delivered are the types of projects that were selected here in Oregon. Oregon selected a very diverse set of projects. Granted, the core of the projects are the overlay and the repaving projects, the pavement preservation projects. But Oregon also had safety projects. They also had operation traffic management projects. They had bike ped projects, enhancement projects. They had rail projects, transit projects, port projects. A very, very wide range of projects. And to me, that spoke a lot about just the thoughtfulness that went into selecting these projects. The sub-allocation issue, that was a big issue nationally. Because of all the requirements asked by the federal government in delivering these projects, now the level of confidence in moving the money to agencies that have not dealt with that program, that again, there is concern with regard to meeting those expectations, you know, in the local governments. And so there was a big concern. Many states struggled with that. And many states didn't live up to near the commitment that was intended, I'll say, in the act. The state of Oregon did a tremendous job in getting money out to the locals, engaging all the locals in this program, and that's evident. I'll go through some numbers here in a minute in the number of projects that have been identified in the state of Oregon. Let's see. So, remaining focused on putting Oregon's back to work. Time and again, I've heard that from the director's office, from Director Garrett, from his staff, that that's what this is about. And ODOT did meet the 50% obligation rate, the requirement to spend 50% of the money within 120 days. To date, my numbers show that Oregon has obligated $203 million of the highway portion of this money, which is roughly 63% of the total $334 million. The numbers get a little confused in that it was $334 million, yet $10 million was transferred to FTA and MIRAD for rail and port projects. So the numbers change a bit, but $203 million has been obligated, and the obligation is a date at which the PS&E, the contract plans, are ready to go to advertisement. So it's a fairly mature project, and that means the project can go out to advertisement and be bid on and awarded to a contractor. The state of Oregon has, to date, obligated funds on 229 projects. That's a huge number. That's 11th in the nation when you compare the states. So there are only 10 other states who have obligated money to more projects. And so that's very significant. And again, that demonstrates the commitment to the local governments and the sub-allocation. To date, Oregon has expended. Now, these are expenditures that have been billed back to the federal government. So to date, Oregon has expended $50 million of the ARRA money, of the $334 million. Now that's 16th in the nation. So there are only 15 other states who have expended more than that as a percentage of their distribution. I must say, in watching the delivery of the Recovery Act program, Oregon has very much leveraged the creativity, which is so evident in everything that's done. The Oregon Department of Transportation developed what is called a 1R guideline, which allows a streamlined approach to delivering pavement preservation projects. ODOT has developed a batched CE process, which has allowed upwards of 100 projects to be delivered through the NEPA process, through the environmental review process, in a single document. That's huge. The time savings, the money savings in identifying an approach like that to get these projects through the environmental review process is huge. And again, it's the creativity and just the persistence of that organization in finding a way to get this money out and spent. Let's see, it was mentioned earlier, some additional funds that have been received through the Recovery Act, some discretionary funds. The state of Oregon applied for and received $880,000 for on-the-job training and support services activities within ODOT. And as well as it was mentioned, the $3.2 million Buena Vista Ferry Crossing project that received some discretionary funds for as well. It was asked earlier about the level of engagement or oversight of these projects. You know, is the money being spent responsibly? Is it being spent well? Very much a concern of the federal government. We're very much engaged in the program. In my office, we have engineers. I have engineers that are out in the field every week. We visited over 40 Recovery Act projects, and we do inspections of them. We have interactions with Oregon DOT, and time and again, we find that the projects are being delivered responsibly and as intended by the federal aid program. And I guess just in closing, when I travel the state, you know, and I'm out visiting with largely state DOT employees, and in those visits, when we go out to a project, we visit with the contractors and whatnot. But I must say, the employees of the Oregon Department of Transportation, you know, it's very inspiring to just see the level of commitment and dedication that they possess. In a time in which the state of Oregon is really grappling with some budgetary issues, there's furlough discussions, there are pay freeze discussions amongst the employees of the state of Oregon. These individuals time and again stand up and they work long hours and they delivered this program. And you can just see the pride in their eyes when they're doing it and the commitment and dedication in their eyes. And they do a wonderful job. And I would say that's largely, and I hear it when I'm out there, because of the very clear and very strong leadership that comes from the top of their organization. Director Garrett provides, this has been a very, very strong priority of the department from the very beginning, prior to the act being signed into law. And the organization, they addressed it and they approached it very aggressively and very thoughtfully and very clearly to the organization. And the organization lined up behind the director's office and have done a tremendous job for the state of Oregon. And the federal government's very happy with the manner in which the program's being delivered. And we will continue to be very engaged with the Oregon Department of Transportation as it's delivered through this year and into next year. And with that, I'll open it up to any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your presentation. How is Oregon positioned in terms of the Tiger grants or other outstanding funds for which we're eligible?
The 14 to 1,500 Tiger grants were submitted. Mm-hmm. That process closed. The submittals were due right at the beginning of October. What day is this? Sorry, the beginning
tomorrow.
Of September.
Tomorrow.
The beginning of September. And the federal government has 3 months to evaluate the proposals and make selections. All I can say is Oregon's very well positioned. They took it very seriously. They pulled together some very good proposals, and they've been submitted. And I would have to expect that they'll compete quite well.
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the positive review that you've just given us reflect well on those grants, or does it come into play at all? My question really is, and my second question is, what if we hadn't done such a good job? What were the consequences?
Well, I would say, you know, having done such a good job is simply a, you know, it's a validation of the health of the organization. You know, I think they do a good job in delivery. I think they do a good job in preparing grant applications and coming up with thoughtful, well-positioned projects. So I do see it related. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and the second question, what if we hadn't done such a good job? What if our director had been out of the country or something? What would have happened to us?
Well, it very much slows down the delivery process. You know, if, again, my office is very much interested in oversight of the federal aid program, of the Recovery Act program. There, you know, there are laws and regulations in place for that delivery. And if the organization delivering, leading that delivery, is not healthy, well, then there's many more opportunities to slow down the delivery.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. You know, I think you said there were 35 other states that were behind us. We really discuss and take transportation seriously. Right? We discuss it all the time. It's a priority for a lot of different reasons in Oregon. And I think the fact that we were prepared is very reflective of our department's diligence, our constantly being at it, and having an inventory of projects that we know need to be done. But I can't imagine them 35 states behind us don't have an equal inventory, but they just weren't prepared. And I think it's just a good message to our federal partners that there's a lot of work to be done out here.
Yes.
And you know what? I tell you, I think it's a good investment to put it into transportation rather than a long growing list of other things that I won't comment on right now. So I think clearly there's a lot more work to be done, and I hope there's more increased transportation funding coming from the federal government to help not just Oregon and the 15 states, but those other 35, who I'm sure are equal need as we are. So that's just a comment from me to you.
I share your passion towards a transportation need and the hopes that funding levels will increase.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I'm going to get some pro Columbia River crossing stickers from the Laborers Union, my old union, to put on the front of our cars so we can get waved through those projects really fast for those of us that are very supportive of a 12-lane bridge.
Can I get one of those stickers?
You can earn one, Representative.
It's like a half.
Forgive
you.
Me, Sarah.
Yes. As you can tell, the Columbia River crossing is a big topic of conversation in this group. So seeing no other questions, we really appreciate your coming today and sharing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Always like to hear that our department is doing a good job.
Thank you.
Okay. I have John Osho and Michael Eliason. And I'm going to call Rob Paul up.
Thank you, Chair Speier and Metzger and the rest of the House and Senate Transportation Committee for the opportunity for us to be here today and speak about the county side of the ARRA projects. For the record, my name is Mike Eliason, Policy Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. With me is John Oshel, the County Road Program Manager, and Rob Paul, Douglas County Public Works Director. And they will describe in more detail the county experience with the ARRA projects. Before I turn it over to John and Rob, we'd first like to thank ODOT for the outstanding job they've done in coordinating and working with Oregon counties as well as the cities. We're well aware that many of the State Department of Transportations around the country did not share and work with the counties and cities to the degree that ODOT did, if at all. Some states, I believe, barely shared at all with local government. So Oregon counties are very fortunate to have the partner that we do in ODOT. And with the ramping down of federal forest payments and the decrease in gas tax revenue, the projects that have come about as a result of the RF funds have been instrumental in keeping local contractors working and county road projects taking place as we work through the severe recession. In addition, the hard work that you as a legislature and specifically you as the transportation committees did last session in passing the largest transportation package in Oregon history will also serve to create thousands of jobs and improve the transportation system in Oregon. And it was reassuring to see that that won't be voted on this coming winter. I'll now turn things over to John O'Shell to describe the overall county process working with the stimulus funds, and Rob Paul will then describe the Douglas County experience.
Chair Spire and Metzger and members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to let you know what is happening with the counties on this issue. Very quick first summary is, you know, things are moving well. That short summary you said on the first page, basically about half of our projects are out the door already and the rest of them are on track. At this point, as far as we can determine, all of them will be getting out the door, although I will discuss a little bit how we're having a little bit of trouble getting all the obligations out due to the wonderful opportunity given us by good bids. I'd like to start really with thanking the Oregon Department of Transportation. You've heard it before, and we just need to really hammer that home. They've done two major things. One is they shared the revenue with us. This has not happened all over the nation, and we really appreciate that it's happened here. And secondly, they have worked amazingly well to help us get all of these projects delivered. I'll go into some of the details on that, but this is no small thing. To put this many additional projects out the door when all the other revenues and all the other projects still have to get out the door also, and to do it with no additional staff, major accomplishment. Part of the process that ODOT has been doing, as well as working directly with the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, they're working with a local program oversight committee that consists of three county road officials, three city street officials, and three of the managers within ODOT. And they've used that as a tool to develop many of the policies associated with getting this out the door. They started working with us clear back in December. We worked through all the early drafts of the bill, and as things kept changing, we kept changing what we had to do to get it out. Basically, that is the group that really worked up the initial recommendations for how the money was going to be allocated. Once you got it to the county bucket, how it went out to different counties, that once you got it to city bucket, how it went out to the different cities. They determined how the individual projects were selected. Basically, then when you get the implement page, once it's been selected, all the stuff you have to get it done, been looking at all the ways, coming up with ideas that ODOT has implemented for how to streamline, shortcut, get things out the door. And this is the group that is being used to make sure that every dime of RF funding that going to local governments gets obligated before March, which is no small task. ODOT is working very hard at that, and they're working with us on it. So we want you to know they are working very closely with us. We really appreciate that, and they are delivering. When you get into the problems with the bill, and certainly there are problems, really there's two guiding principles in that our legislation that sometimes conflict, and the goal is to make them say they don't. First and foremost, it is a jobs bill. The goal is to get a bunch of contracts on the ground in a hurry to put people to work. There's also the goal that says, but we're going to use the existing Federal Highway Administration rules, regulations, processes. And those aren't necessarily quick. And when you really see most of the areas where we've been having a little blips in the road, it's because ODOT, Caterly, has been pushing real hard for the jobs portion of that thing, and they've been hunting for as many ways and new creative ways to streamline things. And that means we've tried a few things that didn't work, and we took a step back and we tried something else until we've got a system that's worked. And so it has been a good process. And they've been working with counties, cities, very closely communicating with us so that when something we had to take a step back and start again, we could get there in a hurry. I guess one of the classic ones of that might be just as we were going on the preliminary, but just before the bill was done, ODOT had actually worked a system, was working with Federal Highway Administration, said, can we maybe set this up that for the very simple paving projects, we can set the counties and cities can award those contracts themselves. Now bear in mind, the standard process is that all money and all contracting for local agency projects is done by ODOT. I mean, that's the standard system, has been basically forever in Oregon. And we said, do we have a certain group of projects that will be most of the projects that we can put out this way? And we were working, we were developing training programs, we're going to be trained and delivered right and so forth. But right at the end as the bill came in, basically a whole bunch of new language was put into the bill that said they want more clarity, more information on every detail of what's going on with all these contracts. At that point, ODOT, FHWA looked at that and correctly, I believe, made the determination there's no way we can have all these agencies doing all this contracting work and getting all this reporting in quickly and rapidly. So they, at the last second said, let's shift back to the old system. This is one of those areas where we thought we had one system going. We stepped back. In about another week, we're up and going the right direction. We've had a couple, three of those happen to us. Once again, ODOT has done a good job of trying to find answers, and a lot of their answers have worked very well, but they've had a few. But once again, it's been a good process. Had a meeting with the road officials last Thursday with ODOT was there, and we were talking about some of our problems on the way, and the comment that was made is, yeah, but isn't it fun having problems spending money as opposed to having problems cutting budgets? So pretty pleased. I'm trying to jump through a couple things here so we're not repeating stuff that's already been said. One of the keys to the process that was set up with county and city allocation, we set up a system so each local agency picked their project within the guidelines given to us by FHWA rules and regulations. So we really gave the local agencies the way to put it in the right place. The prime limitation they had, once again, had to do with that having to get the job on the ground in a hurry. As Matt Garrett mentioned, if you had right away, you weren't going to be able to get through the whole federal aid process fast enough. If you had major environmental, you weren't going to be able to get through the process fast. If you look at the project select by the counties on the first page, you know that about 70% of that is basically going to single lift, simple overlay projects. Very needed, vital projects. I mean, you've heard the county's testimony over and over, we need maintenance preservation. This was a desperate need for us. It is a fact, though, that if we had given 2 years to deliver the project instead of one, you would have seen quite a few different projects. You would have seen a bunch of bridge replacement projects. You would have seen more safety projects, minor widening projects. There would have been another group out there. And once again, sort of as Matt said, yeah, we might have done a little different, but boy, the projects we picked were needed. They were important. We're very glad we got them done. Once again, jumping past some stuff that's already been covered. Getting the last of the money obligated. And Matt had mentioned a couple things. One of the tricky ones that's causing the problems is the fact that we've been getting low bids. And basically, when you had a system to say, hey, we allocate so much money for an agency to spend, and then they work up their plan and their program, and they bid the project for that amount of money, and then you get a bid that comes in 30% less, you've got 30% sitting on the table, and you need to figure out a way to obligate that. Well, it is tricky to do that within even state contracting rules. It's not all federal. You know, you don't just start putting change orders on top of stuff, you know, because once it gets so much work, you really need to be rebidding it. And so we're trying to work up a mechanisms and a series of mechanisms to do that. There is the potential that there may be a few agencies, because the dollar amounts are small, that they can't find another project to do that, they can't get a change order to do that. Once again, ODOT, local program selection, is setting in processes to make sure that all that money gets obligated, because we do not want to leave it on the table. Strongly state Association of Oregon Counties totally supports the concept. We need to get that money obligated, even if it means we have to pull it out of a local agency and put it somewhere else to do it. Now, what the local program committee is working with ODOT, we're setting up a process. Every agency is going to get at least two very clear written notices. The first one's going to be going out pretty quick saying, you've got some issues you have to deal with. You need to have a plan how to solve it so that if you get a low bid in January, we have time to react and do it. So they've got a process to make sure everyone is noticed. They're setting a priority for how that money will get obligated. The first priority, obviously, is come up with a way to make sure that that agency gets the money with another method of obligation. Second obligation is get it at least in the region, the area, the county. You get it in the same area where it was initially planned. If that doesn't work, get it transferred to another other local agency. And if all else fails, we'll at least have ODOT spend it somewhere. In other words, the goal is to get it done. We think we've got mechanisms in place to get that there. And we're working it. Closing, as I started, just thank you so much for ODOT for what they've done. They have done just some amazing work. This is spoken as a person who's had 40 years in the trenches. They've really done some good stuff. Thank you.
Representative Schaffler, real quick.
Thank you. John, on the requirement for the right-of-way, do you, the specific requirement, the detailed requirement that the feds require, is that a clear ownership of the right-of-way? Is that what's required to meet the standard of the federal government?
Chair Byer, Representative Schaffler, actually no, because in fact, when you, especially when you look at the county road, mostly what we have, most of your county roads classically are easements, but what we have to have is a clear right to have that road activity going in there. The delays with the right-of-ways,
What is the clear right consist of? What is that?
In terms of county, it can be several ways they get there.
And okay, maybe I may
it may be a deed. It may be a platted right-of-way. There is a resolution established process that probably 90% of the county roads were originally used with. They're all established in ORS, but there's, in every case, a very specific process for acquisition.
Would just, if I may, Madam Chair, would just an approved application for a permit to build that project, would that be considered enough for the federal government? And I'm going down House Bill 3058 here is what I'm talking about. Okay. Would that application be considered enough to please the federal government? Or do you have to have a deed or an easement? Anyway,
Chair Byer, Schaffler, I'm sitting here as a non-attorney and getting a little nervous. My sense is probably we need something that has gone through the requirement for right-of-way acquisition as required in state law. Bear in mind, when we say right-of-way on these projects, remember in Oregon, right-of-way acquisition laws are more strict than federal law.
Okay, thank you.
So, you know, just we can't really blame all the right-of-way problems on the feds. We protect our citizens about improper right-of-way acquisitions, and so it's pretty dangerous for us to go in there without a pretty good due process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Paul, and then maybe if, you know, anyone does any checking on this, you can let Representative Schaffler know, or let Patrick know, and he'll...
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mr. Paul,
Chairman Byer, Messenger, and members, I'm Rob Paul, Douglas County Public Works Director. And I thought I'd share with you a little bit of how our project went following the ERA stimulus money. And like Matt was saying, we got early notification from ODOT that they were going to be sharing money with the counties. And so that gave us some time to go out and start picking some projects. What type of projects did we want to do? In Douglas County, we looked at a couple projects. We had some of the overlay type work that we wanted to do. Some of our busy roads, that particularly right in front of Roseburg Forest Products, which is major lumber products in Dillard area. We wanted to take that piece of old Highway 99 that's now under county jurisdiction and overlay that. And we had a couple projects in our industrial parks that we wanted to rebuild the road, improve the road into these industrial parks to make them more shovel-ready, better sites for people to come and look at. So we started looking at those projects and coming up with our own designs of how we wanted that roadway to be constructed. And like John was saying, then after we got kind of down that path a ways, then we were given the notification that no, the projects can't have right-of-way, they can't have require environmental permits, and so any new road construction was going to require DEQ permits and going through the NEPA process and Clean Water Act. So all of a sudden, all those projects kind of got taken off the table, and we were looking back at our overlay projects again. And then once we found out that all those federal regulations were going to be required, that also prevented us from letting the projects. So that meant all of our work was going to have to go through ODOT and figure all of our specifications. We're going to have to meet all the federal requirements for DBE, civil rights, everything like that. So all of a sudden we backed up and said, well, this is more than what most counties and local governments can do. So we needed to go out for consultants, or because ODOT just could not handle this amount of work that was coming forward. So ODOT offered up their pre-selected consultants, but those consultants, to get that selection done, we still needed to go out for what they called a shortlist selection process. We had to go out for a small RFP. So that all ate up some time in this process to get these projects designed. But ODOT did their best to get those things through, get the procurement, the consultant selection done for us so that we could get our project started. So once our projects were actually getting going, and we were looking at, once again, it had to be primarily overlays, but then the federal had a few strings on the overlays. It had to be a major collector, a type of a roadway. It couldn't be like a local street. It also had to be in fair or better condition. They didn't want a road that was going to further break down later or require a lot of prep work. So they were looking at roads that were in fair or better condition. And so we've kind of selected our road, and once again, the one in front of Roseburg Forest Products works. It's in fair better condition. It's a major collector for Douglas County. And then ODOT had worked with the Federal Highway to look at doing these contract change orders. Can we do a contract change order and vary the length of the projects? And that process went back and forth. One week it would be, yes, that process will work. You can let your project, it can be from milepost 1 to milepost 4. If your bid comes in and you have extra money, you can just extend your mileposts and use up that additional money. And that's gone back and forth with ODOT's strenuously pushing to make that system work, and the Federal Highway has now agreed that we can do that under a strict set of guidelines, but it will work, that we can extend our projects if necessary to come up with the rest of that money. Once again, that was a lot because of ODOT pushing to make that happen for us. Our project, because of these type of starts and stops, we were hoping to get projects out this summer. But because of the procurement time for the consultants to get them on board, get going, get our projects reviewed through Federal Highway and ODOT before they got out to bid, a lot of ours are just going out to bid now in September. In October, we have a lot of these overlay projects going. Of course, the nice weather changed from sunshine to rain. So that means, like, my particular project was went to bid September 24th, and it'll be awarded probably in about 2 weeks through ODOT's process, but we will not allow the contractor to start $1.5 million overlay in the middle of October. So we're going to have that start next spring or summer as soon as the weather comes back. So ODOT was able to get a lot of money and a lot of paving out this summer to keep the crews working on the freeway, doing a lot of overlays out there in the freeway, and I think next year those same contractors will be doing a lot of local government work, paving our roads and doing our maintenance preservations on the local county roads. So I think to some extent that works in our favor. Our bid, we had, where a lot of times in our local area we have one bidder. Occasionally we'll get two. Because of this project and the amount of work that's going out right now, we actually had five bidders on our project, and ours came in fairly close to the amount that we had estimated. So my change order has to be pretty small just to add a little bit to the end of my project to use up all of our funds. So I thank the ODOT for their diligence in pushing these through and sharing these much-needed dollars for local transportation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question for Mr. Oshel. You mentioned that the state contracting rules may make it difficult for you to ensure use of all the available dollars. Is there anything that we need to consider in the supplemental session to ensure that we do indeed maximize those dollars, or is that something that can be handled through, you know, changes in agency rules?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, actually the issue in hand, I happen to agree with the state rules. Okay. The issue was if you had a bid that came in at half and, you know, you had a $500,000 project and the contractor bid, you know, $250,000, you had $250,000 to actually add that by change order probably wasn't appropriate. If you had $250,000, you probably should bid a new project. And that would be the issue with the change orders. The change orders were just getting too big compared to the size of the project.
Follow up. Thank you. So is there a process in place now to ensure that the rebidding process proceeds apace?
Yes.
Okay. Can you describe that process for me?
What is going on is, Chair Beyer, Representative, two things going on. One, we've a little wised up a bit as to the change in the bidding environment, so our estimates are coming in much better. As Rob just mentioned, they were fairly close on the one they had in September. So A, we will be closer, and B, what we've really done is in the part of the process, we've saying, you know, here's the project. If for reasons of funding, we have had to reduce our proposal, but really the project is this big, and as long as we're not talking too big a number, obviously that 50% won't work at all, but if we're talking 5%, 10%, if the project truly was this side, and we've clearly identified that it was before we bid, then it really leaves us in a better position to, we're being fair with all the contractors when we say, hey, that was a project, it's okay to increase it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other nuances of that, but that's the basic piece of it.
One more question. And he's making the determination that an increase is acceptable. And is there some rule of thumb that you're using to make those determinations?
Yeah. Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, it's a combination of judgment by ODOT staff and FHWA staff.
Mm-hmm.
And we're setting a process in place that they will be reviewing that before the bids are open, so that when the bids are open, they know what direction they can take very quickly. We're concerned about the bids that are coming up, particularly in February, mm-hmm. that we will not have time to negotiate stuff out, so we want to have all our alternatives in place. And so there will be a review by basically ODOT contracting and FHWA. Have to remember, this is all federal aid ODOT program. It is their program. We enter our input, but it is their decision.
Okay.
Representative Schaffler, and then Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Paul, I share your pain, all the hoops you got to jump through just to overlay an existing highway. I can understand, you know, the civil rights is standard. The desire to make sure we have a sound substructure and not overlay some road that's going to fall apart from heavy use of trucks, I can understand that too, but I think that's pretty straightforward. What really frustrates me is, and I don't know why we can't have a basic design for overlay that addresses environmental needs no matter where you are. Why should we have to have consultants come in every little overlay project and say, oh, you know, we have to examine and study this. Why can't that be standardized as well, I guess is my question. And I'm not asking you to answer the question. I'm looking at Matt, too. Because you know what, I believe you're, you know, there's local government, there's projects all over the state where you know right now you could fit into this, but because of the time constraints, you aren't going to be able to because of hoops that, quite frankly, I think can be avoided and still meet environmental standards. And you actually have an opportunity to improve the environment by this overlay. So I'm just, that's a comment more than just a question.
Representative Beyer, Schaffler, actually those processes were starting to get in place before the IRA funding came along, and it was very fortuitous that we've been talking about ways to streamline these, so
yes.
We were ready with this idea. I anticipate a lot of stuff like the batch system for the categorical exclusions will be extended to other federal projects.
Good.
Like I say, details to be worked out, but we see this as an opportunity where we've learned something.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you just answered my question. I was curious if this whole process has resulted in something long-term positive when it comes to process. I think you just said it has. Is it just limited to that one environmental impact processes, or are there others that have improved as a result of this top-down imposed, get it done sort of thing?
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, the environmental one is the one that we've seen the biggest, bestest bang for the bucks and greatest opportunity, but there's been a lot of discussions on other topics. I know this local program committee we're talking about, we've identified as that as one of our tasks over the next few months, is to take a close look at what worked, what didn't, see what spots we have in here where, and basically we're looking at is the project that to reach compliance, the risk is very low. Therefore, let's not have a big ornate process that we have to go through if it's a low risk. That has to do with the consultant selection. That has to do with the PS&E review on simple projects. Plan specification estimates. The review process, that is rather extended process within the existing. If we get a simple, always the same type of project going through, I think we see a lot of opportunities there. And there's already discussions underway as to what have we learned and what can we use.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Now, Craig Honeyman and Catherine Levine and Len Goodwin. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing the cities to give you an update on progress under federal transportation stimulus program. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm the legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. With me this afternoon, and from whom you'll be hearing in a moment, are Catherine Levine, capital project controls manager for the city of Portland, and Len Goodwin, assistant public works director for the city of Springfield. As is usually the case when you're batting cleanup, most of what I wanted to say has been said, and I have given you some prepared remarks, which I will not go through this afternoon. But I do want to, if you will, pile on to the congratulations and thanks on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities to ODOT for the exceptional commitment to communication and partnership that they have shown to cities as we have gone through this process. You've heard the numbers in terms of allocations to cities. I'd be remiss if I didn't specifically thank the department for the commitment to the sub-allocation of the $100 million, $101 million that you've already heard about. That resulted in $19 million of additional funds coming to local street projects and more if you count transit and rail. I also want to specifically thank the department for a decision that they did not have to make, and that is to allocate $5 million to small cities around the state of Oregon, cities under 5,000 in population. That's two-thirds, by the way, of the state of Oregon. There were 124 projects proposed, and I believe 49 awarded by ODOT. Those are making in the process of making significant contributions to pavement, sidewalk, and lighting projects around the state. I want to commend the department for ensuring that federal timeline standards were met by having those apply, the 50% 120-day timelines, having those apply to the projects under their control. Thank the department for, as I said, the commitment they've made to ensuring that cities are aware of project timelines, project criteria, et cetera. We've been very active with the Oregon local partner, local government section in ensuring that our cities, through vehicles that the League has in terms of communication through the League to those cities, are fully up to date on Federal Highway and ODOT requirements and standards. You'll recall, most of you hopefully, that we clearly demonstrated the need at the beginning of this session. We, in order to facilitate our own education about transportation infrastructure needs, and to get cities thinking in advance of not only the legislative session but the availability of ARRA money, we had them put together lists of projects which we shared with all of you at the beginning of the session. That inventory was infrastructure of all kinds, not just transportation, but it's interesting to note that there were of the projects that we looked at, there were 504 projects which were related to transportation infrastructure totaling more than $772 million. So, and that excludes rail and transit. So the need is clearly out there, and between ARRA funds and House Bill 2001, we hope to make significant steps towards addressing those needs. Again, many thanks to ODOT. We are working closely with them to make sure that the March 2010 deadlines are met by our members, that they fully understand the risks of not being far enough down the line by at least by the first of the year to receive those funds, to ensure if funds go unexpended, either because of failure to qualify in time or a bidding environment that is fairly favorable right now, that those funds are reallocated within to the same jurisdiction or certainly to another city within the state of Oregon so that the state doesn't lose those funds. So with that, I am going to turn it over to my city partners. First, we'll hear from Ms. Levine of the City of Portland.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger and Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Levine. I'm the Interim Project Controls Manager for our Capital Improvements in the Bureau of Transportation. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act has really allowed us to fast-track a number of projects using the formula funds, the Surface Transportation Program funds. And it's also allowed us, in thinking about the possibility of competitive grants, to collaborate with our partners, Support of Portland and TriMet, and pursue additional projects. And I'll talk more about those in a few moments. In regard to formula funds, the city worked with ODOT and Metro and TriMet earlier in this year and submitted a balanced multimodal set of projects for consideration. And the city was allocated approximately $14.7 million in SCP funds. Approximately $4.7 million will rebuild and pave roads, Southeast Madison, Hawthorne, and 39th Cesar Chavez Boulevard in Southeast Portland, as well as Northwest 23rd Avenue in the heart of the Northwest District, a major retail and shopping corridor. $2 million will build new sidewalks along Southeast 82nd Avenue, which is both a state highway and a major transit and traffic corridor, along Northeast Gleason in Outer East Portland, and along Southwest Barber Boulevard in Southwest Portland. $1 million will be used to enhance bicycle boulevards across the city. $200,000 will be used for design engineering at the intersection of 82nd and Northeast Columbia Boulevard. That's a project designed to signalize the intersection and support continued expansion of the airport. And finally, $2.8 million will be used to provide energy efficient lighting in the South Auditorium District. That's by the Keller Auditorium downtown. I'd like to stray from the written remarks to address a question that was raised by a number of the speakers that has to do with contingency plans should we continue to receive favorable bids. City of Portland staff have worked with the Oregon Department of Transportation Local Liaison, and the city's contingency plan is to add additional funding to the lighting project and expand it. It actually is a project in two phases. We're trying to have the second phase ready in the event that we do have additional funds available, so we could avoid rebidding or needing to bid a new project. In addition to the dollars that the Portland Bureau of Transportation are managing, the Parks Bureau will be spending $1.8 million to repave a portion of the Springwater Trail. That is the southeast segment of the 40-mile loop in Portland. It's used by pedestrians and cyclists for recreation and commuting daily. And repaving and striping it is seen as increasing the amount of use it will see and increasing the safety for the corridor. Beyond that, TriMet has already spent most of its $2.2 million on transit-related improvements to maintain heavily used transit corridors and enhance the streetcar loop project. The city is on schedule to have all of the construction projects submitted to ODOT for final plan specs and estimate in October, well in advance of the obligation deadline. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank our local ODOT liaison and the local agency section for their assistance in the meeting the reporting requirements. As you know, in addition to providing funding, as some of the other speakers have mentioned, there are many strings attached. One of those is that we are required to provide monthly employment reports to the Oregon Department of Transportation for reporting up to Federal Highway Administration. And we have certainly received the assistance of ODOT staff in making sure we were able to do those accurately and timely, and we'll continue to do so through completion of all of the projects. Besides the formula funding, I mentioned the competitive grants. We have pursued funding for both Tiger transportation enhancements and the high-speed rail application. The projects there are our historic Union Station. We are receiving transportation enhancement dollars to help repair the roof. For those of you familiar with the building, it is the oldest major passenger terminal on the West Coast. It was built in 1896, and it is a multimodal hub in the city. In addition to the transportation enhancement dollars, we're working with ODOT through the Federal Rail Administration high-speed rail application, and additional repairs, rehabilitation, and seismic upgrades to Union Station would be the first shovel-ready project from that application. The city has submitted two Tiger grant applications. The first is the Terminal 4 Multimodal Green Port Project. The second is the Portland Innovation Quadrant. Additionally, Metro has submitted an application for what they are calling the Portland Area Active Transportation Initiative. Their application includes projects from across the three counties, one of which is in the city of Portland. It's the North Northeast Bike Boulevard project. I've included in the information that we've provided maps of each of the Tiger projects, if you'd like to see that in greater detail. I'm happy to take any questions today and would like to invite you to visit the project sites in the future if you would wish. And most importantly, in closing, I just wanted to thank you all for passing House Bill 2001, the transportation package. We certainly see the need for the funding, and we'll be using that to address safety and maintenance needs. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We'll go ahead, Lynn, if you want to go ahead, and then if there are questions.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, thank you for the opportunity to appear here today. My name is Len Goodwin. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Springfield. And like Craig, I will depart from these prepared remarks because most of them have already been covered and just try to highlight some of the issues. Like Craig also, even though you have heard it before, I must join in the unanimous thanks and praise for Director Garrett and the ODOT staff. Without their assistance and without their diligence, I do not believe that local governments would have succeeded in availing themselves successfully of the ARRA money. It was critical to getting those funds into the local economies that ODOT staff worked diligently to design a process even before the ink on the signature was dry. And I just have to reiterate that that entire staff, specifically the local programs office, has made all of this possible for local governments. As the representatives of the county mentioned, as a city representative, particularly one from a small to medium-sized city, we do have some frustration with what the Congress did in terms of how they structured the program. As you've heard, it is funded through the traditional revenue streams, which can carry with them the typical federal aid requirements. We had urged that it be more of a categorical approach, such as the Department of Energy followed in its categorical grants, where there were allocations to specific cities. We successfully completed all of our Department of Energy grants quite quickly and are beginning to fund projects. We had hoped a similar process would be followed by the Congress. They chose not to do so. And as a result, we had to rely on what ODOT was able to do to make this all work. Had they chosen a different process, process in response to one of the questions Representative Bentz asked. We had identified before the legislation was passed almost as much as $45 million in spending we could have accomplished in the city of Springfield on local streets, on county roads, where no right-of-way would have been required, where no environmental issues would have been raised, where design would have been right out of our cookie-cutter design manuals. We could not use the money for that purpose, however, because we were restricted to the federal aid system. ODOT did wonders in making fund exchange available for the small cities and for some of the other city projects, but ODOT's fund exchange pot, if you will, is not limitless. They could not reasonably try to fund most of that $100 million through fund exchange. So we, again, had to be very careful in selecting those projects, not on the basis of greatest need, not on the basis of greatest benefit, but on what could make it through the process in the shortest amount of time with the least amount of difficulty. We ended up with a total of four projects that merged into three. I'm happy to report that one of them is complete. We had completed construction on a 2.5-mile bike path reconstruction that actually was the most difficult project to arrange because while it was in the planning stage, we hadn't designed it. Fortunately, it was a bike path. It didn't require design. And thanks to ODOT staff, again, we managed to navigate a very difficult hurdle about having the right agency sponsor it so that it could move through even more quickly. That project is done. The other projects we have will probably be bid either middle of this month, this coming month, or early in November, or obligated then so that we can get to bid and construction in the spring construction season. We're very confident that we will be able to meet the timelines. One of those projects is, in fact, a scalable project, so that if our other projects come in under bid, we will have the ability to think about moving resources to another project to, again, fully expend the funds and avoid having to turn back, if you will, any to ODOT. We're hopeful, in fact, that we have another list of projects that when other states begin to turn back their money because they can't spend it, ODOT will be successful in taking advantage of some remaining funds that could be made available to the state of Oregon. We believe that our projects, which will cost about $2.1 million at this point, should generate about 50 jobs. That's actually a higher number than the 14 jobs per million that Director Garrett mentioned. And it may be that ours just happened to be a little more fortunate. I think on a grand scale, his estimate overall of about 14 per million is one that seems to be very consistent with general thinking. With respect to Representative Schaffler's question about right-of-way, I think the issue is not the need to get the right amount or right type of right-of-way, but the Uniform Relocation Act, which applies to all right-of-way funded with federal funds, sets forth some very specific requirements that must happen and must happen in the correct way. And if you don't do them, you risk being unable to use federal money. Similarly, one of our projects, we had already prepared to go out to bid. We had to, however, rebid the project because we had bid it under our local standards, the state standards, and that was insufficient for federal requirements, so we actually went out, had to rebid the project. We will obligate that one in the next month or so and be ready to go. But again, it was the process requirements that were, if anything, the impediment to moving this money through quickly. The other projects that we are mentioning, just to tell you briefly what they are, one is a combination of a lighting, street lighting and traffic signal enhancement project in a variety of locations in the city. The second is a very important and critical project that's been on our capital improvement program for a number of years, an overlay of Pioneer Parkway, which is one of the central north-south streets in Springfield. The timing is critical because Lane Transit District now has under construction a long extension of its bus rapid transit MX facility, and this overlay project is necessary to follow along their construction and reconstruct a portion, repair a portion of the street they already constructed. That's what we have done with the ARRA money that's available. As Portland has, we are also proceeding to seek funding for further projects under TIGER. With the support and endorsement of the Oregon Transportation Commission, we have made a grant application for an $80 million construction, reconstruction, rehabilitation of a boulevard that connects the central city of Springfield and Eugene. With that and with support from Mr. DeFazio for further appropriations in the next transportation reauthorization bill, if we are successful in getting that grant, the city of Springfield will be planning on putting on the ground in about 2 years $80 million in jobs and capital construction. That's the sort of benefit that the Reinvestment Act has made available to Oregon communities. We don't know if we'll get that grant or not. We're certainly hopeful. It is a project that offers a unique blend of all modes of transportation, pedestrian, thoroughfares for rapid movement of vehicles, local lanes for access to residential and commercial facilities, and dedicated mass transit lanes. So we're very hopeful that it will be an excellent project and be viewed favorably by FHWA and those who make the award. With that, I thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you. I thank ODOT again for all of the work they have done to make all of this possible. And I, too, am available for any of your questions.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And Mr. Goodwin, I bet you that because of our hoops we have to jump through, there are probably some projects out there that will not be done with this money that actually would have improved the environment had we been able to get going. I find that incredibly ironic, and we are processed to death in this country and state. But Ms. Levine, I'm interested if you get David, Mr. Barenberg, to, I want to know where we're going to fix sidewalks in 82nd and where we're going to repave the Springmark Corridor. The corridor cuts my district right in half, and that you can get that any time. Mm-hmm. But there was a picture in the paper a couple weeks ago. There was a fine gentleman, craftsman, up on top of Union Station repainting the sign. And he was from Wisconsin or somewhere. He didn't live in this state. Now, I can get on the phone right now in Union Hall, and I can get all kinds of people down there painting that sign who live in Oregon. So if we're going to put a roof on that, let's make sure we get people that live here and have a business in this state re-roof that building. I was just amazed that we had somebody up there painting that sign that isn't from Oregon. So that's my comment and my request, but do your best. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Berger.
Mr. Goodwin, with your permission, sir, I'd like to ask you a question that has nothing to do with your presentation. I'd like to know if you are the gentleman that is responsible for that most unique state seal that is in your city hall.
Unfortunately, Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, I have no responsibility at all for that wonderful seal.
Well, it is unique, and I certainly think that whoever did it was very innovative and creative. So thank you very much.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I do have a comment. Since I live two blocks away from the bike path that was paved through the community, and I will tell you, people are thrilled with it, but if you want to get people out on a bike path, the only thing you need to do is put signs on the end of it that say path closed for construction. And they will all be out there watching everything you do and spending their time on the bike path. So with that, thank you. Thank you for
thank
coming.
You.
I haven't passed the gavel over to you at all today. So.
That's right. You're doing just fine. Okay, I'm happy.
I'm going to go ahead and call Tom McClellan up, and
The next subject is Pass ID or Real ID. But before we get to that, we have a member of our caucus that has raised a few concerns about DMV offices. So we thought we would take this opportunity and maybe get the DAS representative up here too in case, you know, you need some backup, Tom. And I don't really want to spend a lot of time, but maybe just kind of an overview. I think the concern was that this is a very important piece of a community and how much the ODOT or DAS takes that into consideration when they are renewing leases or negotiating. I will state that right now, get into any of the negotiations that have been going on, but I do, maybe if you could put some things on the record, because it's not just Corvallis, it's just Corvallis is our learning experience, I think.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan, I'm the DMV Administrator, and I would like to give just a quick overview of where we're at, specifically or primarily around Corvallis, but we also have a couple other offices where there's negotiations in place that may cause us to move. So I just want to give you an update on those. In Corvallis, we've been in negotiations for several months, and those were ended summertime. And as of September 18th, we closed the doors in our Corvallis office and have been working on locating an alternative location and to secure a temporary site for that interim period until we can get into a new permanent location. So it's been about a week and a half now. We have not had a formal presence in Corvallis. We did make arrangements with Oregon State and the Memorial Union to have some staff there a few hours every other week to be available in the community, but we recognized that was not sufficient to really meet the needs of a community such as Corvallis. We've been working very closely with the assistance of our Department of Administrative Services Facilities Division to secure a temporary site, and it looks like either late today or tomorrow we'll have all the signatures for that taken care of so that we can reopen, at least have a presence, you know, an office that people can come to in Corvallis until a new permanent site can be prepared for our occupancy. It's looking like mid-October, so a couple of weeks to have that temporary site up and going. In the meantime, we have redeployed our staff from Corvallis to the surrounding communities of Albany, Dallas, and Junction City, places that are fairly close, still not in the same community, but close, to increase capacity to serve the people who have to travel from Corvallis to other offices. We've added drive lines, added commercial driver licensing in Albany so that CDL testing can be done there. It hadn't been done before. So we tried to make some accommodations because we really did not want to have this effect on the community of Corvallis. So it's not a great answer for you, but it does look like in the next couple of weeks we can be back in business in Corvallis with a longer-term focus on a good location for us and a great value to the state of Oregon. Much cheaper, less expensive lease that will save the state money from what we've been paying in the past and what was offered by our current landlord throughout the negotiation. So it's a good business decision. The downside has been the effect on the community, and we regret that. I really apologize, I guess, for that, but we are doing everything we can to try to get back in business in Corvallis. So that's Corvallis. If you have any questions about that, I'll move on to a couple other locations. But
how much, because a DMV office is probably different from a lot of other state offices, because most of those just don't have that kind of walk-in traffic that a DMV office would have. So maybe closing an office or relocating most other offices would not have that much of an impact, whereas with the DMV office it does. So I guess I would like some assurance that when the negotiation started that this was on the department's mind when they were doing these negotiations, that this is a little bit different animal and will have more of an impact on a community.
Yeah.
Madam Co-Chair, for the record, my name is Scott Herr. I'm the Director of the Department of Administrative Services, and obviously that is a concern for us. It's not only disruptive for the community for us to have to close and move a DMV location, but it's also disruptive for the staff that are involved. And so I think one of the reasons why the negotiations on this particular site went on for as long as they did, we started negotiations in December of 2008. We extended the lease, which was due to expire in March of 2009, into the month of September in order to facilitate having those discussions and to try to reach an agreement without going into the details provide for us to be good stewards of the public funds and also to meet the community's needs. And when it became obvious that we weren't going to be able to do that, at that point in time, we had to cease negotiations with this particular landlord and start looking for alternatives. So obviously, whenever we look at making a move like this, one of the things we incorporate is, what is the cost of that move? And we incorporate that in the new rate in the rent when we do comparisons, because that's obviously a cost that the Department of Transportation would have to incur. So that's definitely part of the considerations. So some of the lessons learned in this process is we're going to be providing more concrete deadlines in negotiations and let landlords know that, especially when it's a 10 market like this, that if we can't get progress and get a resolution by a certain date, that we're going to build in enough time that we can have a smooth transition without a closure in future negotiations. So it's obviously a lesson learned for all of us as we work through this. I think part of it is it very much became a tenant's market, and the landlord was having a hard time coming to grasp with that.
Okay.
And I appreciate that and what you had to do. And I think you really hit the nail on the head in terms of the transition time, where there has to be a cutoff date so you can plan for the next, and, you know, so I'm not going to belabor that. You understand that. I think that's positive. On this particular location, I am curious as to, if you build in the moving costs, what will the citizens of the state save in terms of the cost versus what where you ended with the cost previously with the current landlord?
Chair Metzger, my staff cautioned me to talk specifics while we're still in negotiations and although we're working on it. I will tell you that over a 10-year period that it's in six figures.
And am I in error in that some of these other cities, I think you mentioned Bend, might be the same landlord?
That's right.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I remember in our previous discussion with the department that I had in my office, that was also a significant discrepancy in terms of the cost that was proposed versus what we could achieve with a different office in Bend when that was happening. That was correct?
December.
And is it correct that maybe as a result of some of these other discussions that gap has now narrowed on other places that may be successfully keeping our costs down?
Yeah. Chair Metzger, we are still in negotiations in Bend and in Grants Pass with the same landlord that owns the Corvallis facility, and there has been some recent movement in the price, and again, we're looking at the total cost of either staying there or moving to a new location, and we have to make sure that we're good stewards of the public funds, and so we're still in negotiations. I don't want to get into great detail on that because we're also talking to other landlords at the same time to make sure that we have alternatives in case this doesn't work out for us.
I don't think my only point on that, Madam Co-Chair, is that because I think you articulated in terms of the meeting the needs of the citizens, and we've learned a lesson on that. And you're so, again, I think that's important. But I also want to emphasize the fact that I think the department, motor vehicles, has done a great job in terms of, you know, being stewards of our money, you know, and not spending, you know, a lot more money than is necessary to provide services that in the long run will be beneficial. I mean, you know, up at Mount Hood, where, you know, the difference between Corvallis and Albany, 20 miles between those, you know, it's more than that on a regular basis. So, and I know you worked very hard to notify through the newspapers and others that this was going to be happening. So, I think overall it's going to be a real benefit for the citizens of Corvallis and these other places, and for all the citizens who pay these fees for these types of services, and then what the corrective action in terms of setting your timelines different going forward. I think that's a very good positive, and I just want to commend you for that. So.
And I do too. I don't want it to go without saying that is that public dollar is pretty important to all of us, and we want to make sure that we are getting the best buy that we can. And I am glad to hear that you now have some process that you are going to put into place, because the outroar kind of negates the conversation about saving money and moves to inconveniencing the public. So I'm glad you've learned something through this and that you're going to put that into place. And with that, I don't know if anyone else has any questions, but thank you.
We
appreciate it. And thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. And sorry to derail your great presentation we're going to hear now on Real ID, and it's...
And I'll try to do this pretty quickly for you. I know it's been a long afternoon. The material you're going to receive has a lot of detail in it. I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail, okay? But I did want to just give you some comparisons, a little bit of introduction to a federal bill. It's called the Pass ID Act. It's providing for additional security in states' identification act, but Pass ID. It is in Congress right now. It has been through one Senate committee, and as far as I know, has not been scheduled for the full Senate. And I have not seen a companion bill on the House side. So it gives you some indication of how far it still has to go. But it did get through the Homeland Security Committee with some amendments. It would replace the Federal Real ID Act of 2005. It has some advantages to us, but it does have some drawbacks, and we have some concerns about the Act. I just wanted to go through some of those for you. The bill itself came together through the National Governors Association, National Conference of State Legislatures, American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Federal Department of Homeland Security has actually been very involved in this as well and supports it and has the administration's backing. There have been a lot of concerns, as you know, about security, privacy, costs, those types of things. The changes that they have proposed are intended to address most of those concerns. I don't think it completely addresses those concerns, but it does make some progress there. It also buys us some time. As you may recall, there's a deadline of January of 2010, according to the regulations that TSA, Transportation Security Agency, could stop accepting a state's driver license and ID cards if they're not compliant. As of January 1. It's your guess as good as mine as whether they'll actually enforce that or not. But that is still on the books. What this act would do is, if it passes, the Department of Homeland Security must pass new regulations within 9 months after the act is signed into law by the president. And then states would have 1 year after that 9 months to be compliant. So what is that, 21 months from the time it is signed. So it actually gives us some additional time. And federal agencies would stop accepting a state's cards from someone within 6 years after signing. So it still is time boxed, but that's a concern for us too with an 8-year driver license, to be have everyone through that process in that period of time. So, but it does give us some time, add some additional time. It clarifies that states do not have to provide electronic access to their data to other states, that it's not to create a national database. It removes the charges that we have to pay for a Social Security number verification or an immigration document verification. That's nice. It's a savings to us. An amendment to the bill restored the birth certificate verification process, but it had some caveats about it. Only after a system is adequately deployed, is reliable, and has privacy and security measures that have been addressed. Because there is no system in place today for birth certificate verification. But overall, we think it's going to be very, very similar to the Federal Real ID, and with only 9 months to issue regulations, Homeland Security will probably move very quickly on just the changes and probably, you know, keep a lot of the regulations that are in place today. Oregon's positioned fairly well if this should pass. We do require proof of U.S. citizenship and lawful presence. We do the proof of Social Security number. We electronically verify Social Security numbers and immigration documents. As of January, we'll be issuing limited term cards to individuals that are in the country for a limited period of time. So we'll be in compliance with that. We also have card security features that we believe will meet the requirements of the federal law. A few of the things that I want to draw your attention to on page 2, the bill still has a digital imaging of source documents, still requires the Motor Vehicle Agency to collect, to make copies and store copies of birth certificates, passports, you know, any type of identity document. And I know both committees have had concerns about that provision, and it is still in the bill. It does have a legal name requirements. I think we're in pretty good shape there, except that it depends on how many characters they require for the full legal name. It has to be on the card or in our database. And so that actually could have a fairly large price tag associated with that piece. And I did mention the verification of birth documents. That's also in there. Concerns that we have, I talked about the timelines. Those are still a concern for us, to be compliant within 21 months after the act is signed by the president. The re-enrollment period could be very costly to us to bring people in before their card expires to issue a new compliant card. They did remove the age piece in the current regulations with the federal Real ID. People over the age of 50 as of a certain date have more time. If you're younger than 50, you're considered more of a security risk, I guess.
Can't run as fast if you're older,
can't
right?
Can't run as fast as something like that. That part is eliminated with the pass ID. Mentioned digital imaging and source documents. We may need some statutory changes. We'll have to take a look at the regulations after it finally comes out. We're concerned about federal funding of this. This creates two new federal grant programs, replacing a single one today. I believe it's very, very unlikely they will fully fund these requirements, so it'll be another federal mandate that's not funded. So that is a concern for us. And we will monitor this bill as it goes through Congress, if it moves, and we'll be prepared to give you status reports as it moves along about what it looks like and what, if you should choose to try to comply with it, if you wanted Oregon to comply, what would that take? We'll be prepared to provide that for you.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Thank you for the update on that. And I think a couple of things, one of which is, as my colleagues know, we've talked about this for the last few years, I think this is, and it's the right way to go. It's, I think it bears out the good work that the legislature has done the last 2 years in terms of rejecting a lot of the privacy issues of the Real ID Act, as other states, many of our colleague states have done. And I think that this, like you say, while it's still statutorily on the books, the fact that we're even talking about pass ID in Congress, I think it's hit home to our federal partners that act went too far, and it's not going to take effect the way it was originally planned. And I think my colleagues in the legislature deserve a lot of credit for standing up and saying, you know, this goes too far. And the fact that we've had some significant impact on revising. Having said that, of course, Pass ID is the next, and we'll look at that and we'll scrutinize that as you have done in terms of the impact on the department. But we're still early in the stages of this as well. And so I think it's very important that this legislature, you know, look at those proposals just as we did as Real ID and make sure that our voices are heard on what will be a final product because there's still plenty of time to do that. And it's important to stay on top of that. And I appreciate your analysis. And I always really appreciate, by the way, your side-by-side comparisons on all this. It really makes it easier for us to look at where we stand. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I might.
Yeah. Representative Call, you've been very quiet.
Well, I'll try not to make a habit of it, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm wondering about, you know, and this is a little bit antecedent to
to this specific issue, but for me, I want to make sure that as we move forward, we're also addressing the costs associated with an individual acquiring the documents necessary to become compliant. Someone very close to me has a habit of driving a bit too fast, and that person ended up getting his license suspended for 30 days, which is probably a good thing. I think that it's probably a good idea for him to ride a bike for a while. Problem is that this guy immigrated from Syria almost 60 years ago and doesn't have any documents that prove that he's lived here. And this fella now, once he surrenders his license, before he can even get an ID from the DMV, he has to go through ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, to acquire the documentation that proves that he was actually born, that he was born in Syria, and that he came here. As a coincidence, the name on his birth certificate was Sammy. The name on his immigration certificate is Sam, and that's created a whole nother level of consternation for the federal government. What this means to him is that he has to spend, I think, almost $700 just to get the predicate documents he needs to be able to walk in to an Oregon DMV and fork over close to another $100 at the end of the day to become licensed again. For him, that's a significant amount of money, and I think for a lot of Oregonians, that would be a significant amount of money. And I just want to make sure that when we're talking about this, we realize that a lot of people in this state and in this country weren't born here necessarily, and a lot of people have had documentation for a very long time. They're here legally. They've been documented here legally for a very long time. In fact, they could very well be citizens, and yet still not have enough money to be able to meet the requirements to provide documentation that the DMV now says they need. And what that's going to look like moving forward as we come into compliance potentially with even more stringent federal regulations. So, I just wanted to get that on the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, and with that, I know we have someone else in the audience that would like to add a few short comments. So,
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, excuse me, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for allowing me a brief opportunity. As you know, ACLU, not only in Oregon, but across the country and nationally, has been involved in the pushback on Real ID, and I want to once again thank you all for the work you did on Senate Bill 536, which passed unanimously last session in the Senate and close to unanimous in the House, and did go into law without the governor's signature. So Oregon has joined the ranks, and now we are looking at pass ID, and unfortunately from ACLU's perspective, and again, the pushback on Real ID was bipartisan both in this state and across the country. We really are calling Real ID, Pass ID, Real ID Lite, because as you've heard, it has a number of the features that we raised concerns about, and I think were reflected in Senate Bill 536 in terms of the privacy and cost to the state. Section 242D still does require the collection of the identity source documents that you heard about today. And again, that's been a major issue for all of us in terms of identity theft and creating an irresistible trove of personal information in one location. As best I can tell, the only difference between Pass ID and Real ID is that Pass ID at this point doesn't contemplate a 50-state shared database, which Real ID contemplated but had no funds for, but requiring all the states to build these systems is costly to the states and will eventually lead to linking of these databases. It's just done incrementally. It also really does go back to a national ID requirement because, again, it will be tied to being able to board an airplane or enter federal buildings. And that identity card theory continues along the track of sort of tracking citizens and consolidating and facilitating the consolidation of information. In addition, now you've heard that they're still pushing the electronic system to verify in real time birth certificates. That burden will fall to states because it's the states and the counties that have that information, and that requirement is not specific in the legislation in terms of a date. It contemplates it, and again, it alarms us for the data collection and the cost that this will rise to when it moves forward. Former representative from Georgia, Bob Barr, and the ACLU don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. But on this we do, and he recently said, pass ID, while smoothing some of the rough edges of its real ID cousin and promising to lower the cost to the states, suffers from the same privacy invasive problems. It also, in every sense of the word, is a national identification card. Both, for example, would require cards for access of federal buildings and to obtain federal services, and both would be based on massive database of citizen information, and both would include embedded biometric information, possibly an RFID chip. While you've heard that there is the legislation in the Senate, the House, the Congress has introduced a bill, Representative Steve Cohen from Texas, that would actually do what we're hoping, which is repeal Real ID and then reinstate Section 7212 of the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. And that's the bill that had established the negotiated rulemaking with all the stakeholders, including DMVs, security, civil liberties, everyone, to come to terms with providing some safeguards while ensuring privacy protections. So we hope we aren't back here next session urging you to take the same action that you did on Real ID and maybe speaking out sooner to Congress. We'll urge them to move backwards on this, and at least our congressional delegation. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Seeing no questions? All right. And then I'm going to ask Mr. Garrett to come back up, and he's just going to give us a very brief description of possible bill introductions, which are legislative fixes, because we did make a couple mistakes on House Bill 2001.
No.
But given the work we did, it's pretty good.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I think there were just little oversights here. I think we can clean these things up. They do come from House Bill 2001. The bottom line is a specific section, Section 43A, which speaks to the increase with of fees for heavy vehicles. We forgot to attach it into the sections that allocate the monies out in a 50-30-20 percentage rate to the state, the counties, and the cities. And obviously that was the spirit and of intent that we engaged the Jobs and Transportation Act in terms of the allocations of new monies. Unfortunately, this section didn't make it in, so it retains the 60-24-16 split, and we think an amendment is appropriate to meet the spirit that we engage Jobs and Transportation at. The second issue related to Connect Oregon 3. Connect Oregon 2, you'll recall, had a 2% fee attached to it to help pay for a multimodal fund effort. We have cleared those hurdles. The monies are in. We are working on the study itself. The language of Connect 2 was literally picked up and dropped down into Connect Oregon 3. So now Connect Oregon 3 retains a 2% fee. I propose to you, as you noodle your committee legislative concepts, do you want that? Do you want to retain the 2% fee? Again, it was specific for that multimodal study. Or should you reflect, pause and reflect and say, you know, we need a clean Connect Oregon 3 to run straight. So we've identified what we think are technical adjustments, and we lay that before you for your consideration when you work your concepts as a committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you for the description, and takes this
fees
opportunity to thank everybody now that our deadline has passed for the work they did on House Bill 2001 and what a great job we did for the state of Oregon. And we really appreciate the work that you guys put into it with us to get it done. And with that, that is all that's on the agenda today.
And oh, there's one more thing. We're getting out of here an hour and a half early, so if you have any work before the DMV and want to beat the increase that takes effect tomorrow, you have time to go to your DMV and do that. I took care of mine yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Bernie.
A question about this last discussion on these.
what is, clearly we're going to need some drafts. Is this committee or your committee or the joint going to have some discussion on the 2% multimodal? I think that the Section 43 issues are pretty much of a no-brainer, that our intention was to have that allocation be consistent throughout. We've not had a discussion on the 2% multimodal. Do you want any? Are you going to be taking, I mean, I'm willing to put my opinion out there right here now. I want jobs, not further study, so I would like the 2% to go forthwith, and would support such a concept in legislation. But there may be others who have a different opinion.
I would be happy to take that the input now, and if people have something they want. Representative Boone.
Thank you. I agree with my esteemed colleague to my right.
Me?
You too.
Any other feedback on that one?
Well, I think the point is, as the director pointed out, we've done the work with what that fee was for. So unless we create a new idea to have a 2% fee, I think it would be prudent, because it was an error, we're not starting a new study, that we take the 2% off and make sure as the representative from Salem said, it's, you know, we weren't planning to start a new study, so no use collecting an additional fee. Yes.
Could somebody go round up Peter Wong? We need this to go into the paper.
I chased him off.
Well, and I can't disagree with anything. I think that if there was somebody that wants 2% to go somewhere else, then they can come up with a legislative concept that could ask it to do that, but I think we need to discontinue the funding into the study and have a clean bill.
And Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you for that. I guess I had a need to get this on the record now, because time will be very short when we next come forward in legislative concepts. And I just kind of wanted to get some your thoughts.
Okay.
Today, that's all I was asking for, and I appreciate your indulgence.
Yes, and I mean, we could have a motion to have a bill drafted, or we can just take this as a consensus.
I'm fine with waiting.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate everybody coming and participating today, and we are adjourned. The House is adjourned. Is this it?
Yeah.
We'll have it.
We'll have it.
And we can decide later.
When you get the